And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith. Today is a special in-depth edition of the Wildside News. It's your chance, once again, to learn the good news about amazing people doing great things. Today, Floresta, a beautiful name for a mission of grace to the people around the world hit by the impacts of deforestation. Floresta, when we return here on the Wildside News. Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith. Last day of March, spring is in the air. The longer days are warming the rebirth of yet another year. The Wildside News watches each week as more and more of you tune in. I've got some terrific long-time listeners. Thanks. You know, nature and the environment keep gaining significance in the lives of people around the earth. It's about time, in fact. It should have been done long ago. So each week, more and more people want to know about what's happening in the wild worlds of wonder. That is where the Wildside News is truly unique, because anyone like yourself coming into the voice of the earth can come in anywhere and find the subjects, the shows, the guests who appeal to you. If you're a new listener, head to the archives and listen to anything that gets your attention. We keep growing in many ways. This week, we are expanding the concept of the voice of the earth to include commentary by leading spokespeople. On the front page, you'll notice a link to a commentary by Dave Foreman, the legendary maverick warrior for the earth, founder of Earth First, advocate for action. I encourage all of you to visit the Dave Foreman Forum and listen to his 2005 Earth Crisis commentary. In the weeks and months ahead, he will be adding new concerns and we'll be adding new voices to the voice of the earth, leading writers, researchers, advocates, and others who speak their minds. It's to the point, it's personal, and it's pertinent. And I wanted to tell all of you how you will be adding your personal commentaries in the months ahead. But today's show is a special edition of the Wildside News, and so I will have to put that off until next week. But if MP3 means anything to you, then you have a clue on how this will work. So tune in next week for this important new feature. This week is a special edition of the Wildside News. Today, we will be talking with the Executive Director of Floresta, Mr. Scott Sabin, and Floresta's Director of Development, Joy Berry. I'm sure you, like me, are increasingly alarmed at the stories of the relentless destruction of forests around the globe. At some levels, it has global significance, as the loss of massive forests is like removing a lung from the body of the earth. And from the perspective of animal and plant diversity, the current and future loss of whole ecosystems is something that continues partly because we cannot even comprehend what that really means. History will be left to mourn the loss of thousands and thousands of plants and animal species. Last week, I featured John Perkins, whose Confessions of an Economic Hitman explains the effects these development strategies, which tear out whole forests and tear at the souls of indigenous peoples, have on the future of planet Earth. I just received an email, unfortunately in French, but it appears that Brazil has authorized the clearing of 50% of their remaining forests, already devastated by massive clearing. Today, we go in-depth with an organization that is on the ground in countries around the world working to restore balance to the people and communities which are forced to try to survive when their forest lands are torn away, or even worse, when they themselves are forced to destroy their forests in order to make enough money to survive. Floresta is a faith-based organization that refuses to give handouts to the needy. Rather, they have a fully developed program of human and social reawakening that is having dramatic success. I invite you all to take a journey of hope and perhaps the spirit and dedication
may inspire you to become directly involved. And so now, a special edition of the Wild Side News. It's Floresta.
One of the wonderful things about our planet is the fact that there are people all over the world. And they've been there for millions and millions of years. But here we are now in the beginnings of the 21st century, and some of those peoples and their places on the planet are finding new challenges that they've never had to really face before. And so there are lots and lots of people who, and organizations who are really stepping up to the plate and trying to make a difference and assist some of these people. Some people would call them indigenous peoples. We would call them agrarian people, holistic peoples. And they're everywhere in the world. But they are beginning to face some very unique challenges. And today we're going to talk with an organization, Floresta, that is very much involved in, on the ground, working with people and trying to give them opportunities to achieve self-sufficiency, repair their environment where it's been damaged, and give them options for a sustainable future that otherwise, and without their help, they may not have had a chance to realize. So joining us today to really focus on this topic is Scott Sabin, who's the executive director of Floresta, as well Joy Berry, who is the development director of Floresta. And you can easily find out a lot more about Floresta at floresta.org. So, Scott, let's start with you and give us a sense of Floresta. Give us a sense of how it is that Floresta came to be, and then also let's talk a bit about your mission.
Floresta was founded about 20 years ago by a group of Americans and Dominicans who had been working together doing hurricane relief following Hurricane David. And they became frustrated in giving out basically food aid and handouts day in and day out without addressing any of the root causes. So they decided to dig a little deeper and see why people were unable to make a living for themselves. And came to the very interesting conclusion, and it's especially interesting when you consider kind of the who these people were and the presuppositions they went in with, but they came to the conclusion that deforestation was one of the key causes, one of the root causes of rural poverty in the Dominican Republic. So they founded Floresta with the idea of addressing this vicious cycle of deforestation and poverty. And it's maybe helpful to look at that vicious cycle and understand it a little bit. Basically, rural deforestation causes poverty. Rural people, subsistence farmers, people who depend on the land for everything they eat and sell, are dependent on their soil and their water, first and foremost. And those two things are directly related to the health of the forests. The trees essentially act as a sponge. And so a forested hillside absorbs the water, which percolates down into the watershed and comes out as healthy, clear streams. Without the forest, that runs off and causes some of the landslides. We saw catastrophic landslides this last year in Haiti, directly as a result of deforestation. So those are some of the ways that deforestation causes poverty. But what's interesting is it's oftentimes a vicious cycle. Poverty impacts the environment. The poor are forced to clear marginal land for agriculture. They're forced to, sell charcoal as a income of last resort. You know, it's easy to underestimate that, especially sitting here in America. We know how important oil is to our economy. Well, if you can imagine it, charcoal is just as important in Haiti. 80 to 90% of the energy in Haiti comes from charcoal. When there's no other way to make money, you can always cut down a tree and sell the charcoal. And that oftentimes is the income of last resort for the poor. And so you have this vicious cycle of poverty causing deforestation through clearing and through charcoal, and that deforestation causing further poverty.
Very complex.
Yes.
I think a lot of people who think about local farmers, local people who are agrarian-based and self-sustaining, when they hear about deforestation, they somehow imagine that they're actually living off the forest. And what you're painting another perspective here. and that in essence the forest serves as kind of a buffer to make their life more gentle and more balanced.
That's absolutely right. We're looking at people who kind of are living on the edge of the forest, and one of the fact that points directly at one of the main tools we use, which is something called agroforestry, which is a mixing of agriculture and forestry, planting trees and crops together to take advantage of both. And it's oftentimes an excellent way to build a buffer around the native forest to develop a more sustainable and more long-term agriculture. You know, many people, especially working on hillsides, are forced to move and clear new land every couple years. That's the basis of Swidden agriculture. It doesn't work very well on hillsides, but agroforestry makes that same field usable and productive for years as opposed to maybe 2 years.
The vision is the fact that prior to the deforestation processes, these people lived quite in harmony with their forest and the processes that led to their survival.
It varies obviously from country to country, but most often they've been practicing sustainable agriculture for generations.
So what brought about then this change, this process of deforestation? What's driving that?
There are a couple of things. One is increase in population. Population density forces people to move further and further into more and more marginal lands. A second piece is that the best lands have been appropriated by larger corporations, large-scale agriculture, again, forcing the more marginalized people up into the hills and into the mountains. And then a third thing that you see in a lot of places is migration systems. Some of the most incredible deforestation has been brought about by migration or transmigration plans to move people out of urban zones and develop areas, say, in the Amazon or in Southeast Asia.
So as a result, the forest is gone in many cases. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Right.
And so, therefore, talk about the challenges that they then face.
Well, Haiti is probably one of the clearest examples where 90%+ of the native forest is gone. As a result, most of the topsoil has washed away. People are now farming essentially bedrock in a lot of places. And the rains are unreliable. The streams and rivers no longer flow. I mean, one of the things that's been fascinating to me is to look at the health aspects of deforestation. You know, it has a tremendous economic impact and then a follow-on health impact that is just phenomenal. It's impossible to overestimate the importance of it. I mean, essentially what you're doing is moving from a, you know, I don't want to overestimate, but a Garden of Eden to a desert. And you can just think about what it would be like to, without irrigation, live in the desert, and you get some idea of the challenges that people are facing. Correct.
That sounds like an enormous challenge. You come into an area like that, how in the world can you help?
Our mission is reversing deforestation and poverty and looking at both sides of that vicious cycle and addressing both sides, addressing the economic and the environmental side to that vicious cycle. There are four basic tools we use. The first is community development, and that's really helping the communities to take stock of their own situation, take responsibility for their own problems, and start to develop their own solutions. It's a confidence-building process. The second one is innovative agriculture and forestry, and really we're talking about a whole host of different sustainable agricultural techniques and sustainable forest management, and the intersection of the two, which is agroforestry, as I already mentioned. And then credit, specifically microcredit, which can really leverage the gains made in the agricultural sector and help people to diversify beyond that. And then the third is discipleship. We're a Christian organization, and by working with and through the local churches and teaching people principles of servant leadership, we can help to make what we're doing sustainable.
Let's start with the community concept. How is it that you begin to build that? You suggest that's the first step.
Mm-hmm. Well, the example I like to give of that is an example that comes from a village in Haiti, a place called Cavanac, which is high up on a ridge. You can actually see the Caribbean and the Bay of Port-au-Prince on both at the same time from that ridge. And a place that's incredibly rocky. And I remember that 7 or 8 years ago, my first trip there, just a funny little story, it was about a 2-hour walk up these very steep hillsides. I'd been kind of feeling ill, so I stopped about halfway to rest. I was there with our Haitian director, a fellow by the name of Dezo. And the two of us were stopped there, and a couple of elderly ladies with 5-gallon buckets of water on their heads came trekking up the hill past us and waved and said, "Bonsoir, Blanc," which is basically, you know, good afternoon, white guy. And they asked us, where are you going? And we said, well, we're on our way to the community meeting in Cavanaugh. And they both kind of giggled and said, "Oh, so are we. We'll tell them you guys will be along in a little while." And then they continued on up the hill with their 5-gallon buckets full of water. But when we arrived at this community meeting, we found a group of about 50 people, 40 to 50 people, very discouraged. And frankly, several of them came up to me on the side, hands out, asking for money, asking for things. But during the course of this meeting, a woman stood up and said, "Listen." She started naming organizations. She said, "So-and-so's been here, they gave us food, they're gone." And she was very confrontive about it, too. She kept going, "Organization X has been here, they gave us food, they're gone. How are you going to be any different?" And I was a little bit taken aback, but after thinking about it, I said, well, first of all, we're not going to give anything. And secondly, we're not going to leave until you ask us to. Well, for the first couple years, and our staff was working there pretty consistently. I'd visit once a year. For the first couple years, they really weren't sure what to make of this. You know, and frankly, the group dwindled a little bit. You know, people kind of got frustrated with that. Well, they're not giving us anything. You know, when's that going to happen? But 3 years ago, back in this village, and in a similar meeting, a woman stood up and she said, "We get it. We get it. What Floresta has given us is the knowledge that we're not helpless, but that God has given us talents that we can use to change our own situation." And to me, that encompasses the whole goal of what we're trying to achieve by community development. Once the people are on board and are believing that they have some capacity to change their own situation, then we can bring in, and I wasn't being strictly honest when I said we're not going to give anything, because we have a lot of talents and a lot to offer too. But until people have taken responsibility for that themselves, then our giving things is really kind of a waste of time.
So what do you bring in? How do you manage then to get their attention, get their mm-hmm. respect, or how do you build your relationship with a community?
Well, some of that, again, by putting the responsibility back on them, having them develop some of their own ideas and take the lead in a lot of the planning, and then help them to succeed in some small things.
Like
what?
Builds
their confidence.
Like what?
Like organization to make loans to themselves or to set up their own savings. In the case of Haiti, teaching them to graft fruit trees was a big step. Learning how to graft really developed some of their self-confidence. Teaching them how to practice soil conservation techniques and work with an A-frame to find the contours on the hillside. Easy, small steps that built confidence. And then there's a lot that we can teach in terms of sustainable agriculture, agroforestry, and sustainable forestry that as people have built confidence in the first step, they're ready to take follow-on steps and follow-on steps. In the case of Haiti, and I really like the way that's worked, we help them organize themselves into cooperative groups and decide on their own bylaws, elect their own officers, develop their own agenda. And when they were able to do all this, then we started talking about credit. A lot of people wanted to buy land. They were renters, and frankly, from an environmental point of view, somebody who's renting their land isn't going to put a lot into taking care of that land. They're not going to plant trees on that land because there's somebody else's trees. They're going to take a very short-term view. So helping renters to buy their land through loans and that sort of thing was something they were very interested in, and we helped them to organize themselves to do that, and actually through their own dues and savings to make some loans to the group. When they are able to do that on their own, then we met them with a contribution of capital so that they could make further loans and so forth.
So you help them structure sort of the economics, because economic survivability is mm-hmm. critical. How long does it take? I mean, you're obviously teaching them literally hands-on processes probably that relate to clean water, mm-hmm. Simple agricultural upgradings, things that relate to forestry techniques, things that they can use. There are other things, I imagine. What am I leaving out?
Well, there's really a whole host of technologies. You start simple with one or two, but
give us some examples, because I think it helps create the picture of what it is that you're really providing for these people.
Well, really, the heart of what we're doing is agroforestry, which mixes trees with agriculture, and trees which can provide shade, can help water to infiltrate the soil, some trees which fix nitrogen, some trees which have properties that repel insects, working on finding beneficial combinations of the two, of trees and traditional crops.
You actually do a phased-in planting process to start with fast-growing trees, so things begin, and then you phase in others as well.
Well, one of the things that's important from the point of view, and you're balancing two things. You're balancing the needs of the people, and you're balancing the needs of the environment. One of the things that's important from the point of view of developing trust in the people is fairly quick results. Obviously, trees don't always give quick results. So other things such as nitrogen-fixing cover crops or green manures can be implemented early on. In the case of Haiti, that was actually another area in which the credit helped us, in that that brings a fairly quick result. The trees, some of the trees, you might not see a result for at the front end, 4 or 5 years with some fruit trees, with fast-growing trees for wood products, 7 to 10 years, and for native trees, maybe 25 or 30 years. And so you really have to phase those in such a way that people build enthusiasm about it. If you come in from the beginning and look at slow-growing, high-value native trees, people, I'll be dead before that ever benefits me. But a couple years down the road, people are starting to think about their children. They now have the luxury to start thinking about the next generation.
And so when we return, we explore the future of the world's forests, as Floresta devotes its soul to saving the lives and livelihoods of people of the earth, when we return here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
This special edition of the Wildside News now continues. It's the story of Floresta, which is changing hearts, homes, and restoring hope to people who are faced with deforestation. We're continuing our discussion about Floresta, healing the land and its people, an organization, a nonprofit based in San Diego, but with the success stories and challenges ahead all over the world. We're continuing the discussion with Scott Sabin. We're kind of in the middle of talking about really the effects of deforestation.
There are some things I've heard from farmers that are just amazing. One of the things that has struck me over and over again is it's not just about education. Most farmers know what they're doing. In fact, there's a quote, I think it's on our website, from a Honduran farmer. He says, listen, I know what I'm doing. As a person, I know I'm destroying the land. But how am I going to survive? It's not as if I can just go to the bank and get a loan to develop a farm. So I'm going to cut down the trees. And I know what I'm doing. I'm destroying the land for myself and for my children. Another example that just brings home that sense of desperation is a story that comes from Haiti of a farmer who had a grove of mango trees. Mangoes were out of season. His trees would have borne fruit in 6 months, but he couldn't afford to live, couldn't afford to wait 6 months. So cut down the trees and sold them for firewood. He knows that is not the best way to use the trees, but he also knows that you can't live on nothing for 6 months.
So you have a very long-term commitment with these communities.
That's correct, yeah.
And you're seeing successes.
We're seeing a lot of success, some really fun stuff.
So what are villagers witnessing?
First of all, it's, you know, we've seen villagers, people who are often blamed for deforestation, become the agents of reforestation. They've planted over 2.5 million, almost 2.6 million trees. And, you know, these are the people who most often get tagged with the blame for deforestation. Secondly, we're seeing people utterly transforming their lives in terms of what they're able to do. Farmer just recently got this story of a farmer who said, you know, before I started working with Floresta, I hadn't been to high school. Now my wife and I have completed high school. This year we're starting at the university. We built our house, we built our farm. They have an extensive agroforestry farm growing trees, both fast-growing trees for firewood or for lumber, you know, where they originally would have been illegally logging those trees out of the native forest. And oregano and various other products they're now taking to market.
So what you're really witnessing is the restoration of a natural environment, that healthy buffer between themselves and the rest of the world. What's a typical village? What's the size of a typical village that you're working with?
They actually range quite broadly from several hundred people to several thousand people. One of the things we've seen, you know, we've been working in the Dominican Republic for 20 years, is the increasing urbanization of some of the area. We're working a couple hours, well, it's now an hour and a half north of the capital, because the highways come through, the roads have come through, and development and urbanization has really taken place.
Give people a sense of all the various places that you're focusing your work.
Mm-hmm. Currently, we're working in four countries. We are hoping to expand that to 15 within the next few years. There's basically no tropical country that isn't heavily impacted by deforestation, so the need for what we're doing and the places that we can work are virtually unlimited. As I say, we are founded in the Dominican Republic, and we work on both halves of the island of Hispaniola, Dominican Republic and Haiti. We also have a fairly strong program going in the state of Oaxaca in southern Mexico, and we opened a project this last year in Tanzania, actually on the slopes of Mount Kilimanjaro, working among the subsistence farmers that make their living in the lower regions of Kilimanjaro. We're looking at a number of other places. Thailand is one that's on our radar screen. And actually, I'm going to meet with a gentleman to talk about the possibility of doing some work in Guatemala. So there's a lot of potential and a lot of places that we could work in. Just to give you some idea of the scope of the work within each of those countries, in the Dominican Republic, we're currently working in about 50 communities, 46 I think it is. In Haiti, 21 or so. In Mexico, 25. Currently in Tanzania, just one, but as it's our pilot community, and we've already got feelers out to half a dozen communities in the area. We're also, just within the countries we're working right now, we're looking at an exciting new initiative on the border of Haiti and the Dominican Republic, with our two local teams collaborating. I should mention that our projects or our programs are run by local people. So our Floresta Haiti is 100% staffed by Haitians, with Haitian agronomists and economists and local people from the communities all working together in a team of about 20 people to make all this happen. And it's essentially the same setup in each of the countries. So our Haitian team and our Dominican team are coming together and collaborating to put together a joint project which would cover some of the area on the border between Haiti and the Dominican Republic, which was so badly impacted by flooding last year. This area centered around Jimeni and Fonvrette and a couple other areas is the site of the last native pine forest in Haiti and site of some of the most impoverished and needy people on both sides of the border. And like I say, the site of this flooding. So it's just an area that is, you know, incredibly desirous of the work that we're doing. And it's been very exciting to see the way our two teams, you may be aware, but Haitians and Dominicans do not typically get along well, but the way our two teams have come together as one to kind of put this together.
All told, how many people do you think Floresta is assisting right now?
Approximately 10,000, and you have to do a little bit of extrapolation to get at that, because we'll be working with a head of a household, or, you know, one or two members of a household. But approximately 10,000 people in the four countries.
You are a Christian-based organization.
Mm-hmm.
What I think might be an interesting way, just for you to kind of address the issue of the effects that deforestation has, and how you utilize your Christian beliefs in addressing those. How do you bring those two and accomplish progress?
Well, first of all, it's our faith that motivates us both to take care of the poor and to take care of God's creation, to take care of the environment. That's really why we got into this in the first place. But how it works itself out on the ground is in a couple of different ways. One is we work through the local churches. Usually, we don't work any place unless we're invited. And usually that initial invitation comes from a pastor or a local church or something like that. Then once we're there, it's the local church that often provides the best conduit into the community. You asked earlier, how do you gain their trust? Well, one of the ways is by working through the church, which in many communities is the most important institution in that community. So it really is the key. But we're also reflecting back on the local church and calling them to action. Action on the environment, action in their local community. In the Dominican Republic, we have a network of pastors now who are getting involved in areas that we don't typically get involved in, but who have a new sense of social justice and call to the community because we've challenged them. So they're setting up things like after-school programs for basically latchkey kids. They're setting up schools for kids who can't get into public school in the Dominican Republic because they don't have the right, you know, they can't afford school fees, etc. Just this whole host of social programs that they weren't involved in before, but because we've challenged them. Secondly, by working with leaders, and we call it discipleship, discipling leaders in things like servant leadership, we're helping things to become sustainable. One of the things we found out early on is in a place, well, I'll give you an example, the Dominican Republic, people would experience this vast surge in their income because all of a sudden they were getting more out of their land and they were had their small businesses and so forth. Nine times out of ten, that would go into rum and a new wife or something, you know, something along those lines. And we realized that was not a very sustainable improvement in their life. So discipling those people and helping them to take their newfound prosperity and reach out to their neighbors and make it an ongoing cycle.
What is it that you bring from your faith and the teachings from the Bible, as a Christian, that you feel are the message that helps these people to realize their relationship with the earth?
There's a couple of things. You know, looking back at the creation story, Adam was put in the garden to care for it. And too oftentimes that gets, to steward it, too oftentimes that gets reduced to, you know, to abuse or to exploit the garden. The creation is good. God pronounced it good. And as you look at stories of redemption, again and again, that bears itself out in creation. One of my favorite passages in Scripture, and one we use a lot, is Isaiah 41, 17 through 20. Just a fantastic passage in which the prophet Isaiah is talking and speaking the words of God. And God says, "The poor and needy seek water, but there is none. I, the Lord, will answer them. I will open up springs in the desert and streams on the barren heights. I will plant," and he lists all these trees, "that I will plant in the wilderness so that they may see and know that the hand of the Lord has done this." And I see that it really is, in a sense, that's our scriptural mission statement. The starting point is with the poor and the needy, and they're living in the desert. And how does God answer them? By planting trees and opening up springs. How does that happen? Well, I don't know. I like to think that in one way that's happening through us. We're planting trees and restoring watersheds, and springs and rivers are flowing again. And we've actually seen that happen. And why? To God's glory. So I think that, to me, that's one of our, that scripture is one of our calls to action.
What are you noticing in terms of families and in communities, children, parents, and how these new perspective is affecting their vision of their future in that place?
Well, I think it's increasing hope a lot. In the past, the hope has been to get out of the countryside, to get to the United States, to get to, if you can't get to the United States, to get to the city. And people are seeing the rural area as an area that has hope. the young people are very quick to embrace the environmental message and to get involved. You know, hold their parents accountable oftentimes, plant trees and that sort of thing. And, you know, frankly, in most areas, there's adolescence is something that's very short. The children of today will be the farmers of tomorrow very, very quickly.
There's many aspects to your work, and certainly people who are interested are welcome to go to www.floresta.org, in which case they can get the full spectrum from your website. There's also an aspect of the work that I think is critical, and that is the fact that you also are working in terms of microeconomics. It's a popular term. It has some interesting historical roots, but it works. Mm-hmm. And so give us a sense of how you're applying the practices of microeconomics to your work.
One of the things that became obvious very early on is that in order to plant trees, in order to apply a number of the agricultural techniques, people need some of the funds to invest in that. And so that's when we first started to look into microcredit, microenterprise loans. When we got to places, you know, some of the communities in Oaxaca where the only economic activity is charcoal production, began to realize that diversifying the economy in and of itself was valuable to stopping deforestation. I remember going to a community called La Moraya where the mayor there told me that the only thing that they had ever taken to market in their history was charcoal. So that was the first place, or in that area of Oaxaca, was the first place that we kind of opened up the loans and let people use their own creativity, and I was stunned at the creativity they brought to it. People ask me all the time, what kind of businesses do people start? What kind? And I used to, you know, come up with a fairly narrow list. When I saw what people were actually doing and the experiences and the talents that they were bringing to bear in their businesses, I was just stunned. And, you know, everything from beauty shops to welding shops to you know, some of the things you might expect, purchasing a pig or buying their land or purchasing tree seedlings or opening a small tree nursery, just this wide host of businesses.
And quickly give people a sense of how that works for them. You give them a loan, or, well, you explain it.
The standard way of doing it is to have the people work in small groups, in solidarity groups or peer groups, or in Haiti we work with larger cooperatives. And there's a peer accountability system. So if one person gets the loan, the group is, or one or two people get the loan, the rest of the group is accountable for those people repaying their loans. Usually there's some sort of savings associated with it, and we make it possible so that group members have a place to save money and accumulate a little bit of capital. The loans are typically very small. We started about $65 in Haiti. In Oaxaca, I think they've gone as low as $50 for starting loans. And for the slightly more sophisticated or entrepreneurial people, they may go up to over $1,500 or a couple thousand dollars. It depends on their past history with us. Another thing that is important is typically the loans have a very short repayment period, 6 months to a year. And people will ensure their loans are repaid so that they can take out another loan, a slightly larger one, maybe take on a slightly more ambitious project.
How exotic a business plan do they have to provide?
Usually they're very simple. They're very simple. And one of the things that we do provide along with our agricultural training is some small business training. It's amazing you know, how many people don't have a clear sense of whether or not their business is making is actually profitable. You know, the old story of well, I'm losing a dollar on every one of these I sell, but if I sell enough, I'll just, you know, getting somebody kind of beyond that thinking to look at their cash flow and to make wiser business decisions.
Now, of course, the legacy of microloans is the fact that their repayment schedule is probably beats most repayment schedules for loans in America. What are you finding?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in a couple of our programs, repayment is 100%. You know, I often say over 98% just because you say 100% and people look at you like, okay, there's something wrong with your accounting. And because the group is so important, people will do what they have to do to repay their loans.
So where do you get your funding from?
Well, I'm glad you asked. We're funded primarily by private individuals, and I'll let Joy talk a little bit more about that.
The story of Floresta continues, and I guarantee you will be amazed at what can be done for so little investment when goodwill for humankind inspires good people to do great things. When we return here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
And so, the story of Floresta continues. Joining us is Joy Berry, who is the development director for Floresta. So, Joy, this is a program that reaches thousands of people all around the world. That's really quite amazing. People who support this, where is their money actually going to go?
About over 70% comes from individuals. So the majority of our funding does come from individuals. We also are funded through private foundations. I think the greatest impact that individuals can make to invest in Floresta is through our Sponsor a Village program. The Sponsor a Village program allows Floresta to help people become self-sufficient. It helps individual families overcome hunger by growing more food. It allows us to replant degraded watersheds, causing streams to flow again. We can start our discipleship programs. It's only $30 a month, which is really a dollar a day for many of us. And that goes into a country or a village in either Tanzania, Haiti, Dominican Republic, or Mexico.
Now, do people actually get to participate? That is to say, become familiar with the specific village that they're supporting?
Yes, actually, supporters will get a description of the village. They'll basically get prayer needs emailed to them. They get an annual progress update. Villagers will also have the chance to, through our directors and that, we get emails periodically to kind of update us. That information can also go into the actual supporter. An invitation is also sent if individuals are courageous enough and adventurous enough to meet the people face-to-face in the countries. We have various mission trips. We travel periodically through the year to each of these countries.
That has to be an interesting dynamic. I would think the opportunity to see the fruits of your generosity has to be an extraordinary payoff.
Absolutely. I think for me, I had an opportunity last year to visit Haiti. And that was the first time I just started this year with Floresta, and that trip alone sort of changed my life. There's a whole another story with seeing poverty in this country and then seeing it in actually one of the countries we work in, especially Haiti, because Haiti is one of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere. So for me, I actually sponsor a village in Davi. So to see the villagers really changed my life.
How did that really change your life?
It made me realize that we have so much in this country. We spend money on a variety of things, and I felt that a lot of that money that I was spending could easily help people that are truly in need, that they don't have fresh water. They don't have electricity. They don't provide for their families. I saw a small four-year-old girl walk 3 hours to get clean water. $30 a month can transform and change people's lives. It could give them small loans to start businesses. It can allow them to plant crops in small vegetable gardens in their communities. It helps individuals provide and give their families a future.
What I think is interesting is the fact that this really is almost like investment. You're investing in something that will lead to a real payoff, growth, and profit. And so there's different. That's different than just helping people. I think that's an aspect of the Floresta program that really is quite different.
Right. You're making an investment in human lives.
If people are interested, what are the various forms that they can help to support Floresta? I'm sure you're looking for all sorts of different
Right. I mean, we have special projects. Individuals can help us to build water cisterns to provide fresh water and ways to irrigate their crops. People could, we have vehicles sometimes that we need for individuals to get from community to community. We start small vegetable gardens. There are many special projects that people can get involved with supporting us. How they would do that is they go online, donate now, they can put their credit card information in, or they can go through their bank for a bank draft. Every dollar I want to mention is matched. If an individual sponsors a village, let's say, for instance, in Haiti, for $30 a month, that $30 becomes $60.
Where does that come from?
We have an anonymous donor who has given us an amount of money that every dollar, every person who signs up for Sponsor Village will be matched. So this is actually an exciting time to become involved in our program.
How much annually do you really require to sustain?
Some of the programs, it's about $100,000. We're hoping in the next 5 years to eventually have $200,000 go into these programs, into the countries we work in.
That's almost no money at all.
Well, a lot of these individuals live on a dollar a day, so $1 is like giving them $20 here in the United States. The money goes a long way.
That is actually hard to imagine, that you can literally help thousands of people around the world for that amount of money. That's a bargain.
It is. Yeah. And I also wanted to mention, which helps Floresta a lot, is if individuals would just, maybe they don't want to sponsor a village or they don't want to really get involved in some of the special projects we're doing, they could easily write a check, just send it to us, to General. That allows us to look at our needs and put the money where we feel it will make the biggest impact.
Thank you, Joy. That was it's amazing. Plus, I like this concept of having an anonymous donor. That adds a lot of, that's a great additional element to this whole story. So Scott, let's talk about the future. We have a few minutes left. Talk about what you've envisioned, because I know you're a visionary. You like to see the future and then make it happen. And so what are you envisioning for the future? Give us timelines, 5, 10, 20 years, and maybe even longer out.
Well, 5 years out, we'd like to be working in 15 countries. One of the things that we're working on getting better at and really specializing at is working along buffer zones around protected areas, national parks. One of the things that happens a lot is a developing country with not a lot of money for enforcement will set up a national park. And that national park looks wonderful on the map, but you can, and I've done this in Sumatra, I've walked miles into a national park through cinnamon plantations, and I've, in other places, walked into national parks through areas that have been illegally logged extensively. You see that in Tanzania. It's to specialize in working in these buffer zones around preserves and national parks. Eventually, I'd love to see us planting projects in every country where deforestation and poverty come together. And when I say planting projects, that's another thing we see is that you know, to use the biblical metaphor of the kingdom of God being like a mustard seed that grows into the largest of trees. When we go to a country and set up a program, you know, like right now in Tanzania, we start with one Tanzanian individual who shares our vision. And one community. And she is putting together a team and a program now that works in that community with the thought that in a year it'll be 6 communities and in 5 years she'll be working in 50 communities. And so each of these countries, we're not just talking about one or two villages. Hopefully we're talking about dozens and dozens of villages as these seeds take root and grow into our larger programs.
Well, here's the tough question. We'll do a reality check here now. Is this going to work? I mean, there is such a struggle between the pressures for development and growing economies in developing nations. Which way are we tilting, towards success or challenge?
On a global scale, there's no doubt we're tilting towards challenge. To me, that's a frustrating thing. You know, this past year has been been very exhilarating and frustrating at the same time. As Floresta's grown, as the world has realized better what we're doing, and there have been a couple things that have really brought that out and brought it to the forefront, including the Nobel Peace Prize. Those things have been very exciting. On the other side, it's looking at things like the flooding in Haiti and the loss of life and realizing that had we been there, things could have been different, and realizing the gap between what we're accomplishing and what we need to be accomplishing to really get a handle on this globally, that has been very frustrating. But on a micro level, we're seeing success, and I draw a lot of hope from that. You know, even as on a macro level, things get worse in Haiti, on a micro level, I look at the 20 villages, the 20 communities we're working in, and see the changes in attitudes, changes in tree cover, changes in economics there, and I know it can work.
Well, in that sense, you have a lot to feel good about, and that is the fact that you're actually making a difference for real humans in real places and helping to restore their integrity as people, and their spirit, and their place. We may not be able to solve all the problems in the world, but Floresta is doing a terrific job to really make a difference to real people. And for that, I say thank you. And Joy, why don't you once again repeat where people can come to help support the efforts?
Yeah, if anyone's interested in supporting the work that Floresta does, they can go to www.floresta.org. Then go online, go to Donate Now, and they can get involved in our Sponsor Village program, or the special projects, or they can just give a general gift. We appreciate it.
Joy Berry, Development Director, and Scott Sabin, Executive Director of Floresta, I want to thank you for lending your voices to the voice of the earth here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you. Thank you, Sid.
There's plenty of reason to have hope for this earth, but it will take a lot more of us each day, recognizing that we must now take charge of our destiny. To this end and this beginning, this is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we once again join our Voices for the Earth as we do each week and every single day on the archives around the world and away here on the Wild Side News.